I saw a lot of papers, there's books on culture's impact on what performance is. And I think for a long time going into this, I was open, I was like, surely there is enough data that directly correlates culture to operational performance. When you start to peel back the layers, no one has really gone, here is a direct link from a specific definition of culture into organizational growth.
Welcome to People Powered Strategy, the podcast where we sit down with the mind shaping the future of work. Every week, we bring you candid conversations with chief people officers and HR leaders who are driving business outcomes by putting people first. In each episode, we dive into the real-world strategies behind employee retention, talent development, and organizational growth, getting into the nuts and bolts of building HR systems that don't just support the business, but propel it forward.
Hi, Nick. Thanks so much for joining us on People Powered Strategy today.
Anthony, yeah, very, very glad to be here.
So why don't you, I'm sure our audience would love to hear a little bit more about yourself, kind of your current position, and what sort of led you to your current position as well? What led you along that path?
Crikey. I have a very squiggly journey into landing in a people profession. I suppose currently, just to give you a whistle-stop tour around what I'm up to today, is I'm the VP of Learning and Culture at an organization called Avalere Health. We partner with the healthcare industry to get care to as many humans as possible through marketing, consultancy services, medical communications. I look after how people think and feel at work is kind of like a very quick synopsis of my job title. I grow the business while giving people joy. That's one thing I do. Another thing is I'm currently a PhD researcher in HR and organizational behavior at the University of Kent. I'm a dad, I'm a husband, I'm dyslexic, I am an avid United fan, and every single sport I kind of watch, play, and shadow play everything. I'm forever like throwing golf clubs, like pretend golf clubs in the air or fake dart. So yeah, and I'm just absolutely obsessed with how we can make work more remarkable. I think that is my goal and purpose and why I'm on the planet. So how I got to here is very, very squiggly. Before this, I was the head of HR at a tech company in Manchester. Before that, I was the global head of L&D at a retailer, a tourism retailer. So I got to travel the world to basically play on tourist attractions, which was fun. Before that, I was quote unquote a professional actor. I studied film school in Los Angeles and spent a lot of time in the States. Between LA and me joining this retailer, I had about a million jobs to try and live and make it as an actor, which at some point I can go into if you like. But yeah, everything from working at Hamley's toy store to being a kids entertainer, everything in between. Nothing teaches you resilience like being a kids entertainer, I promise you.
Yeah, true. I was a teacher of young kids at one point. And yeah, definitely you learn how to be humiliated and fail in front of a lot of people. That's when you learn, I think. Great. Yeah. So can you sort of pinpoint a moment, like, you know, because sometimes when people get into a career, they think like, you know, there was a moment where there was a kind of spark of perhaps what they, you know, that was like, maybe they didn't notice it at the time, but it kind of, you know, ignited sort of them along where they to the point where they are now. Or it was like a kind of revealed what they should be doing or sparked off an interest or something. Was there a moment sort of in that squiggly journey where, you know, your kind of interest in leading people, in developing working cultures was kind of, ignited or sparked off, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, cool. I don't think there's ever one moment you can pinpoint you fall in love with something. I think it's just like, it's the same sort of analogy you term when you have a long-term relationship, right? There's not one moment where you fall in love with your partner. There are a series of things that build up consistently over time that makes that happen. But I think there are definitely inflection moments. There was, for example, back when I was, so I worked for this organization, this tourism retailer called Magic Memories, and I joined as a lifeguard, right? I was still trying to be an actor, selling photos at London Aquarium. Wildly, it turned out to be incredible at sales, right? Because I think it was because I was lying to people, which is basically what acting is. And then I was outperforming all of these sales records, doing really cool stuff. At the same time, an agent's going to auditions. As any high performer, overly promoted into a role, 21, I was leading 40 people at aquariums and the Shard and Shrek's Adventure, all these places. But I had this inflection moment where I was like, I love doing this. And what I said to the retail directors at the time was like, let me teach other people how to do this because we'd make loads more money. And they were like, okay. So I ran this, my first ever sort of quote unquote training session or learning experience was at London Aquarium. The backdrop was the Shark Tank. It couldn't be any more metaphorically aligned if you tried, right? And that was a load of fun. I got to do that in Barcelona Football Club and in Dubai. And I was still trying to do the acting thing. And then this inflection moment came for me where the agent at the time said, we want you to go and audition for this Fringe play in Edinburgh. I had a really good opportunity to win that role, I think, look, feel type of role. But the organization said, we want you to go to San Francisco. We want you to open up this store. And I was like, I really love doing this. I'm going to have this moment. So at that point, I spoke to my agent. I said, do you think I can do this? And he was like, honestly, no. I was like, what? What do you mean? It's like, honestly, you're not great. You'll get me some adverts and some work, but you know, it's not. And I was like, cool, that was a really good feedback. And I felt like this weight off my shoulder, not pursuing the thing I thought I should be pursuing and actually instead pursuing the thing I want to do. And that is a powerful moment in your life, to let go of what you think you should be doing and go after the thing you want to do, which is really, really meaningful. So that was one. My daughter was born in 2019. At the time, I was the head of HR at a tech company in Manchester after going through this thing. There was just some moments after she was born looking at her going, holy shit, in like 18, 21 years, she might be working. Like when she works, it really can't suck. Like I had a bad day, right? And I remember thinking after the one, I was on mat leave, I had this moment through, I don't know when it was specifically, but I remember going, I never want her to leave work feeling like this in this moment. I'm like, wait, if I don't want her to feel like this in this moment, surely it's not fair for others to feel like this in this moment. And then I started to go, well, how do I now? I didn't know what I wanted. I don't know what that meant, but it meant something. And so I started to absorb. And then I was like, right, I'm going to start with law. Because if I can understand policy and the bones of organizations, that starts from legality, right? It starts with how an organization legally runs. Then maybe I can fix some stuff. So I did a Master's of Law at Leicester University. During that journey, I moved organizations and took on where I'm at now. And it was through a series of different experiences, meaning talking to loads of different human beings in our industry, started to get under the skin of what made people tick behaviorally, started to do keynote speaking, thought leadership, build things in this organization up, down, experiment with technology, ripping in or out, you know, tech in different places. And then it was about, I was lucky enough to win Learning Leader of the Year with the LPI, British HR Awards, CIPD Awards for different initiatives that I put into the workplace. And there was sort of a moment for me, sort of January 2023, February 2023 time, where I was like, I think I know what I want to do. And that is to make work not suck. And I was like, coining Adam Grant in this and thinking about people like Adam Grant, like Simon Sinek, like Brené Brown, and thinking like, how do we take these ideas and things that are very fun and nice to listen to, but actually make it real in your organization? And it was kind of moments, these different moments led up to me going like, I want to stand for something. I want to make the world more remarkable. Work sucks for so many people. It's the thing we do most after sleep. So it's kind of like a series of those things that have led me to this squealy career. And then it's only really this year where I like, now I have crystal clear purpose. Now we know culture is the thing. This is the lens that means that we can change the work forever. And my PhD is all focused on that, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit. But yeah, so that's it's kind of those stick out, those thorny moments sort of stick out to me in why I'm here and why I'm sort of now attacking this specific purpose of culture.
Yeah, I love how you mentioned that, you know, it's the thing that we do the most other than sleep, because that's a thing that, you know, I heard someone say the other day, which I thought was really powerful. They said, you know, people give the best years of their lives to their work, their profession, which I thought was really, really, really powerful. And when you frame it that way, you're kind of like, God, work sucking shouldn't just be like a kind of like, oh, yeah, whatever, roll your eyes, that's just the way of the world kind of thing. On so many levels, it's kind of like, you know, if you're investing this much time, it benefits both employee and employer to make this, you know, a, you know, in your words, remarkable, fulfilling time, and one where we can both work together, I think, you know, definitely. It's amazing when you talk about the trajectory of, you know, what you've been through. And I can sort of think that, like you said, that there's no one moment, but I think maybe just having that quality of, you know, I want to show other people how to do this is the thing that actually is the quality that maybe led you there. I think some people, you know, a lot of people, maybe they're just happy to get through the day, but you have this quality of being like, no, I actually want to share this, which maybe is, you know, it'd be happy. It'd be great if it was more common, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's a thing we need to make more common, is, you know, make it, create environments where people actually really do want to share their knowledge. I mean, maybe that's a kind of pillar of a good working culture, in a way where people aren't just kind of cut off and siloed or whatever, you know?
You're right. Yeah. It's a shame if people just feel like existing is enough. Like the chance of you and I being here is so slim. We're here, and it's like, how do we just change what we see as a gift? Now, organizations have way more of a responsibility than they're showing up today for society in general. And this isn't just a fluffy, oh, but let's make culture great, like, question. This is a listen to any time a chancellor in the last however many years has had to make some really shit decisions around cutting and squeezing us and the amount of tax we pay. The reason being is that our economy isn't growing at the rate it should be or could be if we unleashed our true potential. This is a fundamentally how we get more pounds in people's pockets question. And for me, it's more about, okay, well, if organizations stop chasing tomorrow and started to stop and reflect inward and think about how do we get the most out of our humans that work for us? How do we play so collaboratively with technology it doesn't drain us and stress us, but actually elevates what we're trying to achieve in the world? Then actually you can start to grow your organizations. I fundamentally believe if you're in a people role, you have two jobs: grow your business and give people joy. Like, you are in this privileged position. It doesn't matter if you're in talent acquisition, L&D, in people ops, or partnering, or a CPO, you know, it doesn't matter. Your role is to grow your business so you can grow society around you, but also give your people joy. So they leave at 5 with way more energy than they started at 9. Like, give them that. Like, you owe them that. Like, you're in this position. You've chosen, you're an adult, you've chosen where to go. So you've got to now step up and own that and find the joy to do it. So, but culture is the thing that interests
them. Yeah. And it's not about being a saint, is it? You know, like, it's the kind of thing that, like, you know, I was saying before, it's remarkable wanting to share knowledge with people. But you can look at it also as in a kind of like, you know, you're not going to get the best out of people. You're not going to thrive yourself unless you can do that with other people. You know, unless you can bring out the best in other people, you're not going to get the best results. So I always think that, like, you know, it's not super altruistic, and it's also not kind of, you know, just a very kind of utilitarian way of looking at a business. It doesn't have to be one or the other. The two actually go hand in hand, don't they? If you can bring out the best in people, you know, your business does better. People are happier. You have a better company. I mean, it just stands to reason, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think. 100%. It's the reason why I chose to research what I'm doing is there's two feelings. Like, you know, I've been through both of these feelings, and they are so overwhelmingly powerful. When you stand in front, or you're in a team meeting or a town hall, and your CEO, your leadership team turn around to you and say, unfortunately, we're having to make some cuts. We haven't grown. We're static. We're stagnating. The feeling of dread that gives you is like, oh my God, am I going to lose my job? I'm at risk. My family, my friends, my partner, what? I can't do these things I want to do in my life. Versus the feeling of an exec team saying, we're growing and we're getting bigger and better, and we're going to pay those bonuses. We're going to give you experiences. It just outweighs anything that we can do, growth, lack of, or when you have it. It's just the most powerful emotion that you can provide people. So we have to figure out how we get more of it without relying on luck, which is what a lot of places do.
Yeah, absolutely. So you speak, you know, you mentioned you've done keynotes, talks on, you know, making work feel good again, and not through perks, but through culture. You know, I guess that means that, like, that's kind of baked into the way that we work. It's not just a bonus. But I imagine, you know, you do face a lot of cynicism. And I think, you know, and the reason for that is not, I don't think it's people's fault. It's because a lot of companies will say that they care about people, right? And they'll do a lot of talk, and then the way that they treat doesn't always reflect that. And it makes people cynical, I think, sometimes. What do you say? How do you challenge that? You know, when you get your naysayers saying, well, that's all very good and well, but is this actually practical? If you can give me like a little snippet from like, you know, one of your talks, how do you challenge the kind of naysayers and the cynics?
Really good question. Some of my favorite humans as well, right? The people who want to challenge and question things as ways to do things. The problem is we've been defining things like culture and engagement the same, my version, well, my thought is the wrong way ever since they've sort of been conceived. So when you think about the traditional definition of culture, the way things are done around here, a set of values, behaviors, norms that are repeated over time, shared assumptions, yada, yada, yada. Problem is people don't connect with the set of values that are plastered on a wall. And you can have leadership teams change, you could have organization change, but the values don't stay the same. But is your culture? No, like it doesn't. It completely gets rewired. And we can talk about that in a moment. I think when you have someone turn up and say, if you're talking about culture, there's no way it's measurable. Actually, the data suggests it completely is. There was a wonderful piece of research done by Graham et al. I can show this afterwards. Went to 1,800 different senior leaders and executives across North America to understand, is culture a thing that you value or not? And they 90% said, yes, it impacts the share price. It impacts their company value. It impacts investor perceived value of their firm. So the most senior people in all our organizations understand that this is a thing that matters. The problem with cynics is they've been promised things early on in their career, or they've been thrown buzzwords like, we're going to change the culture, and nothing happens for them or changes for you on the ground. And the problem with people teams is they don't really know where to start and tackle it. So my advice is to people and to cynics in particular, you're going to stay a cynic unless you see visible, tangible change appear in front of you. And people teams need to stop. And this is one of the biggest problems that we have, the way that organizations work, is every year they'll stand up and say, here's what we want to achieve this year. Yeah. And it's all these lofty goals, which are always wonderful to have. And you get on with the work. And it was exactly the same as it was last year, but slightly different. So instead of telling people what you want to do, tell people what you've done. Because for someone who's cynical, you can't deny facts and figures and data. If you want to transform the onboarding experience for your new starters, don't tell people next year you're going to have a brand new onboarding experience. Just change the onboarding experience and then tell people, look at our brand new onboarding experience and the 20 people that have gone through it and what they're saying. All of a sudden, the cynic in the room goes, hey, yeah, not, haha, told you, because that's what the change is. But you can only start to really change that once you redefine these big hairy words that we've used in people for years and generations. Like, you can't change values and make people live them in a week. Like, it just doesn't work. Culture is messier than that. It's not as linear as that. It's different. There's multiple facets to it that you can own and change. But you've got to draw the dots between value and what value means for your business and how you then start to change and interact with the actions that you take. And only then will people who don't believe you start to believe you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I also think as well that people treat it as a thing that you can just implement all at once, you know, and they don't realize that it's like a garden that needs tending, right? It's like something that needs to be cultivated and tended to again and again and again, especially with something like people as unpredictable as human beings. And then also, you know, I guess, with, you know, people coming in, new people, new hires and things like that, who are you hiring? Do they fit that culture? Are they being onboarded in the right way? Are they being, you know, are they aware within a week of like, you know, what your vision is and what your values are? There's so many different moving parts, I suppose. So you can understand how it has to be a very rigorous process and also how it can go wrong. Because it's really, really, really difficult to manage. I wonder if you could maybe speak about that a little bit. Like, what do you see as being like, what do you think is like the most common mistakes that people make with this kind of thing? Like, what is the overlooked factor maybe in kind of developing working cultures that people miss that leads to things going awry?
Yeah. I think you mentioned it there, but a lot of people define culture and it's very static. So it's a set of things and that makes your culture, which is completely the wrong way to look at it. Your culture is alive. It is living. It is rewiring. It's purging. It's reinforcing absolutely everything that you do and you say. And ultimately, it's how the organization makes decisions. It's how it frames failure. Is failure something that gets banked, remembered, and used to fuel growth? Or is failure something that gets punished? You sweep it under the carpet and you pretend nothing ever happened. All of these moments, actions, once, twice, repeated, start to reinforce your pattern. I call these patterns, right? Start to reinforce the wires that take place, and they build these cognitive maps. And that is consistent throughout everything that you experience. And one of the big issues that T organizations have is they focus it as a HR thing as well, right? So we tend to say our HR are our cultural custodians and we'll implement values and hiring people align with our culture, but no one can define what their culture is. Ask a room full of hundreds of HR professionals three words to describe their culture. You'd be amazed they come out with political silo, don't worry. And so, but we don't then start to take the specific actions and address the root cause of the issues. If you've got a silo culture, people might be afraid to speak their mind because of the way that you're A, dealing with diverse voices, if you're not allowing different voices into the room, B, the way you make decisions, and C, the way you treat failure and innovation. So people end up just staying in their box, not wanting to rock the boat, and just getting through. And we say we've got a productivity problem. Of course, you're never going to drive growth if people don't take risks in order to change what their product is, what they're offering, or how they're interacting with customers and clients. So the first step is for people, professionals to go, can we redefine it? Let's actually tackle this. Let's make this everyone's role, not just HR. It's a leadership responsibility as well to make sure we're setting the tone. And then let's figure out how we're doing work and why work is happening in a certain way and why specific decisions are getting made. But take the pressure off to try and land at a destination. I think everyone is striving for this. I mean, I balk at it sometimes, but we often throw around this high-performing culture word, right? Everyone wants a high-performing culture. Define it for me. If I was to talk to, I talked to a CPO a few weeks ago and they said, how do we get to a high-performing culture? I said, define high-performing culture for me. And they were like, well, you know, where everyone is doing their best, right? Define best. And ask two questions and it stumps 90% of people before you get into a definition. So the first thing is you'll define, how do you want people to show up? What are the things you want reinforced in your culture? Values are important, but they only form part of what it is you say to the world and what you believe in the world. So you've got to realize that culture is multi-layered and multifaceted, multi-domained. So redefine it, be very crystal clear what that definition looks like, and then consistently act on it. Tell people what you've done and drive that drumbeat. Like I go back to the beginning, there's not one thing that's going to make your culture. It's consistency that actually drives and delivers a culture. Consistency of actions.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's difficult, isn't it, to sort of, there can be no one definition in that case, isn't it? I think it's you know, all the only real firm definition that you can give is that you just have to establish it. Like whatever it looks like for you has to be in place, and it has to be imparted or shown through actions, I suppose, is the most important thing. Can people see it? Can people define it? I think is really, really important. Definitely. Can you then maybe talk a little bit about like what is? Can you give some examples maybe of things that you've seen in companies, like the opposite of what we've talked about, where like, you know, maybe just like little behaviors that have really kind of seemed small almost, but they're kind of like a small part of that culture engine that kind of hold everyone together, like little things almost, you know, that people might overlook, that define a good culture.
In your culture, I mean, interesting, go back to the definition of it. I define it as like the organization's living brain, and it's through maps, wires, patterns, sparks that fueled by experience. I think what we experience is the thing that shapes and fuels your culture. So for example, one of those little things is names. I was doing some research on names recently. So the importance of names. So if I refer to as Anthony consistently throughout this podcast and I keep coming back to your name, you feel that sense of trust with me. So leaders who know, and it's like, if you're a leader, never say I'm really bad with names, for example. It's something I used to fell in this trap years ago. I was like, I'm really rubbish with names. I'm so sorry. Learn people's names, learn how to pronounce them correctly. And all of us, like, honestly, it's incredible. You see the uplift in people's eyes and faces when you refer to them by their name. Names are so personal. So leaders who are consistently calling out their people by their name frequently is really important. I've seen that work wonders in small groups who just want to build up relationships and trust. When you have high levels of trust, you can build psychological safety, you can innovate. So names are important. The other thing is, how does your boss's boss treat you? So I see this a lot, is how does your manager's manager treat you? Do they reach out to you? Do they check in with you? That will tell you a lot around the hierarchy and the importance placed on hierarchy in your firm. So if you never hear from your boss's boss, then maybe the hierarchy is incredibly rigid and there is a span of control that will probably stifle and kill innovation. If you're frequently in contact with your boss's boss and they are human towards you, when I say human towards you, they care about you. They ask you how you are genuinely. They don't ask you how you are, then very quickly tell you everything that's going on with them in their lives. They are genuine. Then again, that tells you you've got a healthy culture within that micro culture within the team. And bear in mind, when we talk about culture, your organization, no matter if you're 20 or 20,000 people, there will be pockets of micro cultures that form your larger one. Some will be incredibly strong, some will be incredibly weak and unhealthy. That tells me boss's boss speaking to you. Yeah, that tells me great. People using names frequently, that tells me great. People managing and balancing transparency without oversharing is incredibly powerful in your culture. We can't give salary increases because we're not doing that great. It's so much better than saying, there's no money, sorry, not sure why. Or going, we're on the brink of collapse. I'm so sorry, we're gonna go out of business next Tuesday. You know what I mean? It's being able to balance the transparency with oversharing is a sign of a healthy culture. I think when it comes to some of the really cool things I've seen other organizations do is, how do you allow people to spend the time that you have them for? For example, if you claim to be a purpose-led organization, but you don't give people time to actually live that purpose, for example, volunteering, if you're working in social care and giving people time off to go and volunteer somewhere, if you're a product that is trying to solve a solution in child care somewhere, but you don't allow people flexibility to pick their kids up, then no, like your culture is a complete confliction of terms. So whatever you tell the world you are and you stand for, you've got to make sure that every action, interaction, working back from that is aligned to that purpose. Otherwise, your culture becomes fractured. All of these moments and enough of that fracture at the time creates unhealthy cultures. So there's all of these things that people really take for granted. And one of the biggest words that I'm drilling into leaders at the moment is the word intent. Like, take a second, stop, like pause. How could you impact this person's life slightly differently? Be intentional versus automatic, because we're rushing from one thing to another, to another, to another, which makes time seem like it's just flying. But the reason is we're not intentional. We're just literally going from one thing to another. So I go to a meeting, so I'm not even thinking about my line reports, line E, am I, as a boss's boss, right? So it's like, how do you be more intentional?
Yeah, I love that. You know what? You really struck a chord with me there. That was a real bugbear of mine. Is I've had managers in the past who kind of, you know, they use that line of like, I'm direct, and you know that's just kind of the way I am, and you know I'm very straight to the point. And it's always kind of a little bit of a thing with me where I'm kind of like, yeah, but I'm not really sure that's like the best quality to have, you know, if you're someone leading a team of people. But I'm, you know, I try and be sympathetic and I think like, oh, well, maybe these are qualities you can learn. I'm curious for your perspective on this. Can managers learn to be more personable? Or do you think it is literally like a case of like, you know, some people just have those qualities, some people don't? What do you think?
I think we are... Every single one of us is a product of our environments. We all have preferences. We all prefer to get to it. I prefer to use emojis in my emails and like, hey, how are you? So good to connect, right? That's my preference. But whatever we learn, I think this is one of the biggest, and you go back to like, what's a healthy culture or some of the things you've seen that make a culture. Your ability to unlearn is just as important as your ability to learn. Like unlearning the bad stuff that you've done previously, maybe you've learned from your boss, because remember, managers without any form of education or shaping or the right experience will just tend to relay back how they were managed. So if you're able to unlearn some of that, it's key, and everyone has the ability and capacity to unlearn. Learning, like the best analogy I can give, it's so funny we just forget this, like learning to drive a car or ride a bike, right? So you can't jump in a car for the first time and then drive it on the motorway. Like, you've got to learn how a car works. Yet we assume in the workplace, when we think about management, you're just a manager, off you go. Problem is, like, you've got people absolutely knackering the clutch, killing the gearbox, brakes are shot, crashing left, right, and center, because we've not given them the tools to drive the car properly. So everyone has a preference, right? Built up of how we were raised. Honestly, it goes back to childhood psychology, all of that. We all have preferences in our life, but really, absolutely everyone can tweak, unlearn, become out of things with a bit more of a beginner's mind and reshape how they lead and manage. Every single leader has a brush and is a culture designer. It's just the ones that have intent, imagination, are willing to unlearn, who are going to create cultures that are super healthy for people to thrive in. Leaders, managers who are robust in the way they think, unwilling to listen to perspectives, take feedback on and role model that and create that safety for people to speak freely, will engage in crappy microcultures, which will just impact and inflect. We often say it starts at the top. The only reason why it's more important to start at the top is because that person has more of a profile and those teams manage larger teams. So your microcultures will ladder up into one big thing. And you've got more people, but there'll be wonderful people lower down your organization who are listening actively, who are remembering names, who are giving a shit about their people, really listening intently and understanding who they are. Doesn't mean you don't have to be direct and confront when you need to. Like if you see something that should not be allowed in your culture, you don't want rewired or reinforced, then you've got to call that out and stamp it, right? But you don't have to do that at the risk of being an ass. Like you can still do that and give people meaning and purpose on their journey. Like, yeah,
I couldn't agree more. Let's talk about your PhD research. I'm really excited to learn about this. One of the things I'm really curious about in particular is your kind of breadth of research into this. Because I imagine you've had to look at the whole history of work. My question to you is like, have you managed to uncover, have you looked at like what, like when, I guess, like working culture became a thing on people's minds, on people's radar, when it became a thing that people were actually felt they had to be concerned about? Do you kind of look at the historical side of it in that way?
100%. I've just written a chapter. I'm talking to some people about this on Friday, because the nexus of my PhD, my thesis is, I don't think the way that we've thought about culture works currently. I think the definitions are far too static. I want to bring a new definition of culture under this idea that culture is the living brain of our organizations, this brand new framework. I then, through my fieldwork, will be taking this definition and mapping it against high growth organizations. Organizations that are growing year on year. I'll take all of that field data and research, then provide a blueprint, again, mapped against these new domains, this new definition of cultures. So any organization to pick it up and go, oh, that's what they do when we talk about maps or wires or patterns or sparks, right? But yeah, just to go back to your original question around understanding when all this idea began, is actually in the 1800s. There was this guy called Edward Tyler, who basically started to coin this first definition of culture. He said, it kind of fits, like, right? So we're like however many, 150 years more than later. This idea of culture is a complex whole, which encompasses science, beliefs, arts, morality, laws, customs, habits acquired by people in the social state, right? So if you think about the ideas, it is a complex whole. Culture can be seen as this complex whole. And then that moves through the eras. In the 80s, you had people like Edgar Schein bringing things to light, which is a group has shared assumptions, values, and beliefs, artifacts that are crystallized over time. You've got Dennison thinking about the same thing, about values that are beliefs. Hofstede talks about this idea of it's the software of the mind and societies. And all of them are great. There's clan culture, there is hierarchy, there's market innovation culture in a new framework. All of those are great, but they're not meeting the need of what it is today. If I said to a CPO, how are you finding your organization? And she says, or he says, I want to change my culture. I don't know how to do it. If you gave them a definition, they're like, don't worry. It's just shared values, belief, and behaviors. They're going, how the hell do I even start with that? Thank you. And what I want to do is completely change that and transform that and bring this brand new definition, which is going to, I believe, transform the way we work and make it more remarkable. Because when we think very, very simply around the definitions of culture, when we think of it as an organization, living brain, right? It's about the shared maps that shape our meaning, And cognitive maps are what all the signals that we get. It's the purpose statements. Are we a luxury brand? It's the interview process. It is those things that are slaps on the wall. It's what we tell the world, but it's also what we read on Glassdoor and what we see in LinkedIn and what people are chattering about the business in the corridors, right? Then it's about the formal wires of systems and incentives that carry those signals. That's how are people actually promoted? How decisions actually get made? How does work get done in our organization? And then it's the patterns of behaviors that those signals produce. So every meeting, if you only ask the same person the same questions, you don't allow voices to come up and share their thoughts, then obviously that's going to crystallize some element and a negative part of your culture. And the final domain is sparks. And the sparks is the piece we just spoke about around learning and leadership. It's the intent from leaders who can draw on their own lived experience to give people meaning, to re-engineer the system, rewire it when it's needed to, and their behaviors, their modeling is the thing that shapes the whole thing. And all of that is encompassed by what we experience. So everything we see, feel, smell in our business completely feeds into the sparks, the patterns of wires, and the maps, right? So those four domains of maps, wires, patterns, and sparks, that's what I'm going to be going into organizations to figure out how they learn, how they lead, what they repeat. I'll be able to take all of that good stuff to say, high growth organizations do this, they say this, they're repeating these things, go and do it, right? Take your version of that and re-engineer it. So that's the idea. Anyway, and then produce a thesis.
Yeah, and I love that because you're not telling people what their culture should be. What you're kind of doing is you're saying you're presenting them with you're basically presenting them with human psychology, you know, in a way. You're kind of saying like, you know, culture is a series of behaviors, gets reinforced over time, right? And, you know, if you encourage these behaviors or discourage them, then you have certain results, you know. If you have certain patterns of behavior, it reminds me of kind of when I was in uni, I did psychology, and it was kind of like, you know, the classical and the operant conditioning and things like that. You know, it's the kind of the process of kind of like people see this behavior and they get it done to them again and again and again. Eventually that just becomes a learned behavior. And it's very, you know, it can be a learn, but it gets more and more difficult as it goes along. So in a way it's very kind of psychological what you're doing, isn't it?
It's all about human behavior. It's all about organizational psychology, but it's understanding that that culture is so layered in different ways that if you change what people see, that's the first thing. If you want people to see something different about your organization, you have to change that. If you want people to actually act a different way, how your work gets done needs to evolve and change. What are you repeating consistently? So we're giving people this like health check as a result to say like, we don't want to create a place where every culture is the same. What we want to do is create cultures where people grow and people have joy. So in growth comes joy, right? There's hard and there's pain, and that's okay as well. But then growth comes joy. So what we want to do is say, well, look, if you're doing this today and it's not working, try this. Because for these organizations, there's 100 organizations in the UK that have grown year on year, whether it's in SME, whether it's in health, whether it's in biotech, whether it's in retail, doesn't matter. These are what their maps are. This is what their wires are. This is what their patterns are. And this is what their sparks are. Try some of this because it's working for these 100 organizations that are growing. You're not growing. There's something wrong with that, right? So you're not growing because you're not innovating, or whatever you're offering at the minute isn't landing. So there's got to be something different we can do. So it goes back to the societal thing. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And then also, you know, you mentioned things like Glassdoor, your social media space. I think, you know, this is also a digital world. And I love that you brought that up because I think that's really impacted work culture, actually. I don't know if you agree or if you've seen this yourself. Like you just mentioned how the old models of culture don't work. They definitely don't work now because of, just how online everyone is and how online work is and how global everything feels all the time. I don't know if you experienced that yourself or if that's something you've looked into in your research.
Yeah, 100%. There's research in the field, there's a lack of connecting. There's a lot of like, you know, AI and how AI impacts things like innovation or L&D upskilling and bits and pieces. But when it comes to like actually being online, the old definition of, well, what, you know, how do you fit a value which says we are accountable into a digital world where no one actually has to be accountable for the words that they say or their keyboard, right? Very difficult to do that. But And I go back to this point of maps, which is the stories that we tell ourselves. Before you join the organization, now everyone is researching, right? So you do all the research, you look at Glassdoor, you look at LinkedIn, you look online, you do your whatever that is. You're constantly drawing this story in your head. And when you join the business, you continue to draw the story. Your map just evolves and changes. And everything you see, the problem that we, one of the worst things about the way we work digitally at the minute is that we're so quick to believe everything we read, right? Because we're so quick on, we're not like slow reading things and being autonomous in our research. I had a really interesting article from MIT around like ChatGPT is just actually making, if we don't use it properly, it's making us dumber, right? Because we're allowing it to do all the thinking for us. We're not actually critically thinking about stuff. So we run this horrible risk of creating this terrible cognitive map that everything's rubbish and bad and woe is me and sorrow, instead of actually using cognitive planning and actually just thinking deeply, critically about what we're reading and hearing. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you. I think it's, could you talk maybe a bit, because, you know, when you go into sort of research, you know, if the research is honest, I suppose it's like you go in with certain assumptions. We can't help it, can we? We all have assumptions. And then I guess the good research is when it's predicated by people being open to surprise or open to new discoveries and things like that. Can you talk about something in your research that completely challenged assumptions that you had and that really surprised you and has changed the way that you think about culture now and that you're going to take into your future work?
I think on the surface, I saw a lot of papers, there's books on culture's impact on what performance is. And I think for a long time going into this, I was like, surely there is enough data that directly correlates culture to operational performance. And you know it. Like when you think about it, you've got like culture strategy for breakfast. Everyone knows a poor culture. But honestly, like when you start to peel back the layers, and I have deep research and I have about 50 pieces of papers in my lit review ready to rock and roll and synthesize, and no one has really gone, here is a direct link from a specific definition of culture into organizational growth. They talk about performance holistically, but they don't get under the skin of growing organizations. And it amazed me that the lack of correlation exists, honestly. So it's like, why that made me pivot and change is that we are desperately crying out for correlative data that says this culture results in this level of organizational growth, and this is why. We know it adds value, but at the minute it's perceived value. It's like, I assume that it adds value because it's just what we kind of know about it. And I think so much is staying superficial. Not enough is going really deep into the definition and the nitty-gritty within these organizations to experiment, to find out. And so, yeah, that's what's caused me. So changing assumptions, actually going through this, because originally I thought I wanted to just find out the link between learning specifically culture. And now it's all about, no, like I am going to be I want to be the world leading authority in the space of culture, right? That is that's my lofty, big, hairy goal. That's what I want to achieve. And to do that, I think the assumption was there's not enough correlative data that we can arm people, professionals, to go into their boardrooms and say, ha-ha, it's this. Like, it doesn't really exist. And it's hard to find. The other thing I found out was that academics are wonderful people, but really, really bad marketers. Because there's some really good papers out there. Like, right, there's 18,000 study that shows the value of culture is really important. Or personality and traits influence how people perceive culture. All these kind of things are brilliant papers, but they're not read by more than like 1,000 people, only in academia. And you're like, the world kind of needs to know what you're saying, guys.
Right. What are you doing?
Yes. So I'm like, we need to change that as well, because it's all well and good adding to like a PhD. The whole point is you're giving back to academia. You're filling a gap, a research gap, right? But only to add more papers into the world cannot be the reason. It has to tangibly change an organization. Change one, you can change two. You change two, you can change an industry. You can start to really drive change. You change an industry, you can change society. So it's like you've got to think that big. And I don't think these papers go big enough. I also just challenge the assumption of having to go so niche in PhD. It's really funny just like doing a PhD in 2026 and knowing what I know and having worked for so many years and understanding how we can work more smarter, innovate quicker, and then the institutions that are trying to drive this research really don't actually want you to work that quick. It's just quite funny, I find.
Thanks so much for your time today, Nick. It's been great chatting to you. Thank you so much, Nick.